This is not easy for artists, whether it is a visual artist or a poet, to say, well, I was pretty good. Sure, but there's somebody better. There is somebody who does this better than I. And minds sort of fade away by comparison. Because, of course, what we are doing here is purging the sense, the sin of pride, and we're obviously trying to learn to practice humility.
Yeah, notice, of course, that Dante is getting a twofer here, that he's dealing with politics and with art, because those are two professions, if you will, where pride is going to be most immediately the problem. But of course, those are his two professions as well. And so this is a profound meditation where the pilgrim is learning something that he needs to know very, very desperately. And it's sort of interesting to see this idea of, you know, willingness to give credit to somebody else. The Sienese in politics, one artist ceding to another here, first in illumination. Now, illumination is kind of interesting because it's putting pictures on a manuscript. Notice how that brings together painting and the written word, just as those two were brought together in the previous canto. But it also is a very interesting way of talking about shifts in style. And Dante, living at a time when such a shift was taking place in the art in Florence, is very much aware of it and talks about the two artists who, in a sense, most embody that shift in his own time.
And thank goodness he does, because we, in fact, cannot be sure of any single manuscript illumination that was painted either by Odorizzi or by Franco Bolognese. We can't be sure about anything like that, so we can't really make the comparison. But we're told this. Once Cimabue thought to hold the field as painter. Giotto now is all the rage, dimming the luster of the other's fame. Two Florentine painters, a generation apart. Cimabue dies in 1302, Giotto in 1337. And we do have their works, and we can talk about changes in style. By the way, if you're ever in Florence and you walk into the Uffizi, the great painting museum there, room one has a huge Madonna by Cimabue. And right over there is a huge Madonna, the same story, by Giotto. And one can literally, in the same room, go from the style of Cimabue to Giotto. And the one thing, more than any single thing, that characterizes that change is toward greater realism. In particular, more three-dimensionality, more depth of the figures, the very movement toward the kind of painting that we see by analogy happening in sculpture from what we said about the sculpture that's actually around the Terrace of Pride.
Notice, by the way, we shouldn't take this for granted at all. Dante's estimation of these two is pretty much what is our own if you're taking Art History 170. I mean, in any kind of basic survey of medieval and Renaissance art, the textbooks are going to say the same thing that Dante says here. There's this sense in which Dante, as poet, really does know what's going on. But it's also interesting to see that having made this point about how styles change in art, he then applies it to the art of poetry as well. He goes from talking about Cimabue and Giotto to talking about poets of his own generation. So one Guido takes from the other one poetic glory. We've already seen who one of these Guidos is. It's the poet Guido Cavalcante, whose father, Cavalcante, is back in hell. Well, it turns out that this Cavalcante, this Guido, has taken over from an earlier poet, also named Guido, a poet named Guido Guinicelli. And as the text says, already born, perhaps, is he who will drive both from fame's nest. Well, there's a really interesting line, because, of course, it sounds like what's happening is that Dante is giving a plug for some new guy who's coming along, namely Dante himself. Well, what are we to make of that? Doesn't that seem as though it's another sort of outrageous example of artistic pride if Dante is suggesting that just as Cimabue gives way to Giotto, this guy Dante is going to come along and take the glory from these other two folks? Well, I think it would be possible to look at it this way were it not for the tercet that comes immediately afterwards. Your earthly fame is but a gust of wind that blows about, shifting this way and that, and as it changes quarter, changes name. Which is to say, if What you're interested in is fame and reputation. It's going to come. It's going to go. That's not ultimately the reason for you doing this kind of thing. So that even though what he's doing is talking about his own work and bringing his own work into the discussion of all these artists from different media, from illumination, from painting, from poetry, what he's saying is that it's not primarily about stylistic innovation, that there are larger issues to be dealt with. And of course, that all goes back to the beginning of Canto 10 when we talk about the purpose of art being moral improvement. That's what it's there for.
In that final political hunk, Dante meets the co-victor with Farinata of the Battle of Monteperti. And Dante sort of asks, you know, how did he get this far? Wouldn't I expect to find him down in hell? And the story is told where, in fact, toward the end of his life, one of his friends was in prison and needed some money for ransom. And since Provenzano Salvani didn't have it, he actually begged for money in the piazza of Siena. That is to say, somebody who had won the great victory had, in fact, turned to begging in the Campo of Siena. And if there's ever a symbol of humility, that's it. He had started on his way.
Lecture 15, The Vision to Freedom.
In this lecture, we're going to get to the actual center of the Purgatorio, which, of course, is also the center of the entire Commedia. But we have to sort of cover a little bit of ground to get there. You'll recall that we were talking about the circle of pride pretty intensively in the last lecture. And in fact, there's a little bit more to it, that in addition to all of those positive examples that we saw last time of sculpture on the side of the mountain that Dante and Virgil are climbing, the souls who are bent over, okay, with the weights on them, also get a chance to view another kind of sculpture as well, sort of pavement sculpture. It reminds us of those tomb rubbings where they see the actual sins of pride, again, taken from biblical and classical sources. So just as you had the spur to good activity from looking at the virtue of humility, souls also get to look at pride and its consequences directly. And from pride, we move to a second capital sin, a second tendency towards sin called envy.
We want to make two brief points about this terrace before we pass on to the third, that of wrath, where we're going to spend most of the lecture time today. But Dante's walking along in the terrace of envy and is looking for somebody Italian to chat with. And so he says, anybody here who's Italian? And he hears this answer. My brother, all of us are citizens of one true city. You mean, is there a soul who was a pilgrim once in Italy? It's a reminder of the fact that citizenship on earth, if you will, is provisional. Whether you're French or Sienese or Florentine or Italian or whatever, but rather here in purgatory and later in heaven, this means much less because your identity is not with your fellow fill in the blank, Italians, French, Norwegians or whatever. Your identity is with the saved. But the person Dante chats with here is very interesting. She tells the story of watching a relative of hers whom she did not like being killed in battle. And how joyful she was at this misfortune of her relative. In addition to the story generically being interesting, as it turns out, she describes the death of Provenzano Salvani, somebody we met back on the Terrace of Pride, the victor, along with Farinata, at Monteperti. And so it's still another story that's drawn from that collection of stories of Dante's youth. He died when Dante was 4 years old, in fact. It's another way of constantly bringing forward to our attention all of the reasons for and outcomes of those factional wars that took place and were still taking place in Italy generally and around Florence in particular.
And notice also what it says about the nature of the sin of envy. what you want is to see bad things happen to people that you don't like very much. So if pride is all about your place, your exalted place in the universe, envy is sort of coming at that through the back door, maybe through a shot off the backboard. What envy is all about is seeing other people, in big trouble and getting your jollies that way. Well, as we move to the next terrace, that of wrath, we are, as we said, in the exact center of the poem, whether the poem be Purgatory or the entire Commedia, and it probably shouldn't surprise us very much at all that a poem as carefully constructed as the Commedia is going to say something very important, that this is a poem that demands that we pay very close attention to its architecture, and here we are, dead bang in the middle. And it's kind of interesting to see what happens, because it turns out that in this canto we begin a fairly extended discussion of the central problem of free will, an issue that really turns out to govern an awful lot of what has already come in the poem and an awful lot of what is going to come in the poem as well. And we do this, again, as is the way in the poem, through a very interesting encounter between Dante the pilgrim and an inhabitant of the afterlife on the terrace of wrath.
It turns out this fellow named Marco Lombardo is somebody that scholars have had a great deal of trouble identifying and tracing and finding out biographical information about. He's not, for his own story, a very important character, if you will. But Dante has a question to ask. It's time to start asking some of the big questions. He observes that the world, indeed, as you have just declared, is destitute of every virtue known, swarming with evils, ever breeding more. And then, what is the cause of this? Please make it clear that I may teach the truth to other men. Some set it in the stars, some on earth. It's a very important question. Why is the world so screwed up? And Dante offers two possibilities. One possibility is a kind of deterministic possibility. Maybe it's in the stars. Maybe this is all governed in some way that's out of human control, or maybe the cause is on earth. Dante's got to get this big one settled before much else can transpire.
Now, that first possibility, that it's in the stars, elicits this sort of sigh of desperation from Marco Lombardo, the sense that, pilgrim, are you really that stupid or that naive? Remember, this is not Dante's own position. He's just simply saying, here's what people think, that some people think that it's all destiny and we have, therefore, no control, no freedom. Marco says, alas, the world, brother, is blind, and obviously the world is where you're from. That's an insult, I think. You men on earth attribute everything to the sphere's influence alone, as if with some predestined plan they move all things. And Marco is very quick to draw the obvious conclusion from this. If this were true, he says, then our free will would be annihilated. It would not be just to render bliss for good or pain for evil. Which, of course, means, among other things, that the whole system that the poet creates here would be meaningless. The fact that there is a hell as a kind of embodiment of justice would make no sense. The fact that there is a reward in Paradiso would make no sense either. So, essentially, the whole system collapses if we find out that freedom is a kind of illusion. But it's also interesting to think about this. Here he's dealing with the notion that the stars influence our lives. Now, we also saw some examples of this back in the Inferno. Brunetto Latini told Dante, if you remember, to follow his star as if somehow, as we said, it's in the stars that he's going to succeed. And so there's one example of that kind of determinism. But the fact is that everybody in Dante's time would have agreed that the stars exercise some influence over us. They suggest that we are all born with certain predispositions. In other words, what we tend to see as something inside of us, kind of a genetic code, something in our DNA, they saw as having to do with the alignment of the cosmos. In other words, a kind of cosmic DNA taking place outside of us is what causes people to be predisposed in one way rather than another. The question then becomes, what happens when you carry this notion to its extreme? And that's the issue that's being dealt with here, because, of course, what happens is that if you carry to its extreme, you annihilate freedom of the will.
After all, this is a serious matter. Sometimes today, we tend to think about things like astrology as sort of silly. Even people who read their charts every day in the newspaper, ultimately, most of them don't take them very seriously, or what they read in their fortune cookie or whatever it might be. But Dante's suggesting that the point that you start with, if you believe in astrology seriously, is an incredibly damaging one, because what it allows you to do is get yourself off the hook. It allows you to say, well, I just did this thing. I just insulted my mother. I just stole some goods, or whatever it might be. Gosh, that's all been decided by the stars. And therefore, I don't have to take responsibility. And so what Dante realizes is, if you take this and this tendency that Ron talks about and turn it into a system that explains everything, again, we would call that astrology today, what you've done is given yourself a colossal get-out-of-jail-card-free. And this is what Dante realizes is dangerous. How can people come to grips with the reality of their world and with the reality of who they are if they simply say, well, I'm not in control, I'm not in charge, I didn't create this mess, all I'm doing is living out a script that somebody else wrote?
Now, notice also that if you deny that astrology is the last word, that means that you have to accept the notion that you have freedom and that therefore we are responsible for our actions. But Dante the poet is a long way from suggesting that freedom is simply a given that we all have and can exercise however and whenever we want. Again, Marco still speaking here, says, the spheres initiate your tendencies, not all of them, but even if they did, you have the light that shows you right from wrong. Okay, so that to have a tendency in a particular direction doesn't mean that you have to succumb to that tendency. I have a tendency that says, I like chocolate. Chocolate is really good. It doesn't mean that I have to eat chocolate whenever and wherever I see it. Okay, if I were to do that, I'd be down there with the gluttons. But what you have is a tendency that has to be guided some way. And what he says immediately after this is very interesting. Your free will, which though it may grow faint in its first struggles with the heavens, can still surmount all obstacles if nurtured well. If nurtured well. What Marco seems to be saying to the pilgrim here is that freedom is not a given, right? Simply because there's no such thing as astrological determinacy, that means you all have freedom. What he's saying is freedom is an accomplishment that we are working for. There was an earlier line in the Purgatorio where Dante is told that what we're doing here in Purgatorio, we are all in search of freedom. So this is a particularly meaningful discussion for the Purgatory, for that sense that what you're trying to do is increase the opportunity for freedom, and also, more important, increase the capacity to act freely. And that's what Marco is telling Dante here.
And so, at the end of this little piece of the canto, Marco Lombardo concludes, the cause of things having gone astray in this world lies in yourselves and only there. And then he goes on to explain something very important for us to consider. He says, you know, think of a little kid, think of a little kid who likes chocolate. That obviously is something that needs control, that needs training, that needs education. And here, in a way that very closely follows ideas of Aristotle, he asked, what about teachers? Of course, everybody knows that families are teachers. But Aristotle recognized that one of the most important teachers, a teacher, if you will, that has more authority than the parent, is the law. We come back here, in other words, very quickly from a discussion of free will to a discussion of politics. It seems like an oddity for us at first that he's making this leap from something very personal within us to this sort of structure of society. But it makes perfect sense if we realize the need to develop that freedom and restrain, not annihilate, but restrain our own immediate desires. He says this: men, therefore, need the restraint of laws, needed a ruler able to at least discern the towers of the true city. Remember, he's already told us that Rome has, Italy has laws. We've got Roman law, the greatest body of law ever created, but there's nobody to administer it. And so it doesn't do much good to have laws. In fact, Dante's already said it's more shameful to have laws and not follow them than not to have any laws at all. So here's a situation. There's no emperor, and the Pope is trying to usurp certain imperial jobs. And therefore, Dante comes right back to a political passage. Again, something we wouldn't expect. He talks about the Pope, and then he says, "And so the flock that see their shepherd's greed," okay, the Pope's and the bishop's greed, "for the same worldly goods that they have craved, are quite content to feed on what he feeds." In other words, if you've got bishops and a pope who are greedy and who in some uncontrolled way go after money and wealth and political power and fame, if that's what the leaders do, that's what the followers are going to do. And so we turn to discussions of law and leadership within the context of this broader discussion of free will.
Notice how, again, this works retrospectively to illuminate large chunks of the Inferno. Quite obviously, the question of free will does that. These are people who are there because they have chosen their fate in the afterlife. This is what they have decided in their heart of hearts that they want more than anything else. But notice also that Marco's answer ultimately is that the question that we started out with is, how come things are so screwed up? And Marco's answer is bad leadership. Now, it's interesting to use that and go retrospectively back to the Inferno and see how many of the big-time, serious, world-class sinners that Dante deals with are people who are in a position of leadership. That we're talking, for example, I mean, the best example might be something like Inferno 19, where we're talking about the spiritual leadership of the church. And as we pointed out then, there's a kind of trickle-down effect where if the leadership at the top is corrupt, then so also it's going to be that way all the way down from pope to bishops to priests to parishioners. And what Marco seems to be saying here is that there is this kind of domino effect of evil, and that this is the major thing. You know, when Dante looks around and says, "I see a world that is really messed up," this is the reason for it. And again, as Bill pointed out, very interesting to go from what seems to be a kind of personal issue discussing the nature of freedom of the will, what it consists of, whether it exists, and so on, and to move right into the political question from there. You can't really separate the one from the other. It's a point that Dante comes back to over and over again.
In addition to this being, as I said, a very Aristotelian passage, I would also want to argue it's a very prophetic passage, drawing a lot of energy from the Old Testament prophets. There's a wonderful scene where Jeremiah looks around and says, "Boy, things are really messy here. I mean, things are really bad. And so what I'm going to do, I'm going to go to the leaders. They will know better." In other words, his immediate response is, the problem is folks aren't following their leaders. Then he looks at the leaders and realizes the problem is folks are following the leaders. That is to say, they are acting in their own smaller scale exactly the way the kings and priests and so-called prophets are acting. And so sometimes when people look at Dante's Commedia, it doesn't seem to our eyes very small d democratic. Doesn't seem to have the right balance of peasants and laborers and workers and all that sort of stuff. And sometimes people are a little bit annoyed by the fact that so many of the characters in the Commedia are such important figures. This explains why. What Dante has to learn is the nature of leadership and the problem of bad leadership and how it really does trickle down to every level of society.
Yeah, and of course that also turns out to be a particular lesson for Dante himself. Remember one of the things that we said earlier, Dante's choice for the pilgrim, who you're going to meet, right, turns out to be predicated on who is going to have the most to say to him in his particular situation. So we saw all of the categories of sin in the Inferno. The ones we spent the longest time with are the ones where Dante had to kind of get himself out of the tendency toward that sin. But it's also interesting that if you look at it in the purgatorial manifestation of the same process, one of the reasons why there's so much emphasis on the role of leader is because Dante himself is going to have to assume the role of a leader through the writing of the poem. And so in learning about this, in learning about the importance of leadership in the stability of a world order, it has a lot to do with his own mission of writing a poem where, again, in the fiction that he creates, he tells the world what he has seen in this trip to the afterlife.
As we continue this discussion with Marco Lombardo, ultimately, we turn toward another topic that seems once again to be a very personal topic. In other words, we seem to go from personal to political back to personal because we have a long discussion, again, right in the middle of the Commedia about love. Free will, leadership, the discussion turns to love. And we need to begin by taking a look at a distinction that Dante makes in Purgatory 17. Neither creator nor his creatures ever, my son, lacked love. There are, as you well know, two kinds, the natural love, the rational. Natural love may never be at fault, the other may, by choosing the wrong goal, by insufficient or excessive zeal. And as it turns out, that particular set of lines is the beginning point of Dante the poet's discussion of the entire structure of the purgatory.
Yeah, because when you're talking about love, perhaps the most fundamental thing turns out to be what we love, all right? Well, what does that mean? It means the choices that we make. We've cleared away some of the debris that's sort of important to, you know, sort of stands in our way of this because, of course, without free will, our choices are all illusions. Now what we're coming to, various ways of saying what we choose turns out to be what we love. That in a very real and important way, those two things are synonymous. Now again, in the passage that Bill just read, two kinds of love, what he calls natural and rational. Natural simply means a desire for something. Okay, again, the terminology and the ideas come mostly from Aristotle. Everything acts toward an end for a purpose, and what that purpose is turns out to be what we love. Well, is it right to talk about it if you're dealing with the natural love that a doggy has for a fire hydrant? Okay, sort of goes there and uses it to do his thing. Well, what this passage says is that that's sort of the natural love. It's a kind of instinct that the will doesn't enter into. Rational love, things that humans can do, essentially has to do with our ability to make choices. Okay, so that when you look at this, then you can see that love consists in the choices that we make. And what follows in this canto and the next is a fairly interesting discussion of how you can sort of categorize those choices. What are the possibilities for both good love and bad love? And of course, in doing that, what we're doing is giving the system that not only explains the seven-story mountain of purgatory, but that explains the whole system of the Commedia. And that begins to sort of suggest to us that what we're dealing with is this gigantic love, this gigantic 14,000-line love poem.
While it is fixed on the eternal good and observes temperance loving worldly goods, it cannot be the cause of sinful joys. But when it turns toward evil, or pursues some good with not enough or too much zeal, the creature turns on his creator then. So you can begin to see how Dante is making these distinctions. We can seek out lesser things and make them our ultimate goals. It could be money or lots of other things. Or we can love something in and of itself good, because remember, in the Christian scheme of things, everything that is good because God created it. We can seek something with excessive zeal, or we can seek things with insufficient zeal. And so this becomes sort of the tripartite division of purgatory. We have the three terraces that Christ, new risen from the tomb, appeared to the two men on the Emmaus road. A shade appeared. Well, that in itself is interesting. We have another Christ figure. It's even more interesting because it turns out to be a Roman poet named Statius.
Well, it's kind of weird that you would have a Roman poet being introduced by his likeness to Christ for openers. Even weirder is the fact that at the end of the last canto, there was a very interesting phenomenon. You know what an earthquake is? There was a mountain quake. The seven-story mountain quaked, and it turned out that it was quaking for joy. That's sort of the signal that a soul is ready to rise from one level to the next, to go up higher. And once again, the figure for whom this was done is the Latin poet Statius. Now, Statius is a poet who is not as much studied these days as he was in Dante's own time. He was certainly never somebody who had quite the reputation or the pizzazz that Virgil did, but nonetheless was recognized as one of the most important of the Latin poets. And so what we have is a really interesting group of folks now when you add Statius to Virgil and Dante, because one of the things that turns out to be particularly interesting is that Statius is not only sort of introducing himself here, but he's also going to hang with them for an awfully long time as they continue to go up the mountain. Statius himself is free. And so in the time that he's hanging with Virgil and Dante, we learn an awful lot about him. And this is one of those very interesting places where what was known about him from classical antiquity kind of combines with Dante's own poetic imagination. And Dante does sort of additions to Statius and his life, which are every bit as daring as what we saw him doing with Ulysses back in the Inferno.
Let's take a look at the story that he tells after the introductory remarks are over. During the time of the good Titus, this is the Roman Emperor Titus, who ruled in the 80s AD, who, assisted by the King of Kings, avenged the wounds that poured forth blood which Judas sold. Before he was emperor, he had in fact conquered and sacked Jerusalem. "I bore the title that endures the most and which is honored most," the soul replied. "Renown I had, not yet the Christian faith." And he tells about his poetic career and then says, "The spark that kindled my poetic ardor came from the sacred flame that set on fire more than 1,000 poets. I mean the Aeneid." And he goes on to say, "And if only I could have been alive when Virgil lived, I would consent to spend an extra year of exile on the Mount." Virgil was his inspiration. Virgil was his poetic model. Now, he doesn't know that he's saying this to Dante and Virgil.
So you have this wonderful dramatic scene. Virgil was my guy. He's there with Virgil. Well, are they going to be able to keep this as a secret? It turns out that Dante is unable to. The surprise, the joy at the situation, hey, I get to unite these two famous poets, is a little bit too much. Virgil turns to Dante. "His look told me in silence, silence." Okay, we don't want to give this away, but the power of a man's will is often powerless. Laughter and tears follow so close together. The passions that provoke them, the more sincere the man, the less they obey his will. So now he's sort of given something away, and Virgil says it's okay to give the rest away. And so Dante turns to Statius and says the following: "You seem to find my smiling very strange," I said to him, "O ancient spirit, but I have to tell you something stranger still. The shade here who directs my eyes to heaven is the poet Virgil, who bequeathed to you the power to sing the deeds of men and gods. Well, once again, that idea that we mentioned earlier on, that in purgatory, it's a place full of surprises, and the surprises turn out to be good ones. I mean, Statius is saying, boy, more than anything else in the world, I'd love to be able to meet this guy Virgil, and there he is. Okay, so there's this wonderful surprise, and the way that he reacts is not surprising, because, you know, here he's met his idol, okay? Already he was bending to embrace my teacher's feet, but Virgil, brother, no, you are a shade. It is a shade you see. There's something inappropriate about here in this part of the afterlife, one poet bending to do homage to another. So it's kind of interesting then that you have a situation where three great poets are now hanging out together. And there's a really interesting set of relationships in terms of the influence of one on another. We've already seen at the very beginning of the poem the way in which Dante has looked at Virgil as a model. Now we see Statius saying, hey, Virgil was my model too. So there's a kind of interesting way in which Statius then is sort of linked to Dante through their mutual respect and admiration for Virgil. And it's also interesting to see the way in which Statius has taken from Virgil something rather different than what Dante does.
Now, up to this point in the story, there's nothing new in the sense that what we're told about Statius in Purgatory 21 is stuff that was generally known about Statius. As we move to Canto 22, we get, if you will, the rest of the story. And it's a quite a striking story. But before the story continues, a little pause in the action to ask Statius a question. You just said you spent 500 years on this terrace before this mountain quake occurred. Now, that was the terrace of Avaris. How could somebody like you, how could somebody that read Virgil's poetry, how did a smart guy like you be greedy? That seems like sort of a surprising thing for somebody like you. And he gives an explanation that sort of startles us. He said, well, that wasn't it at all. But there's the opposite sin from avarice, which is prodigality, of not valuing money enough, if you will. And that's what I was guilty of. And so as it turns out, these two opposites are punished on the terrace of wrath. Interesting, in Inferno 7, we have the wrathful and the prodigal in the same place, crashing against each other. Here we have them in the same place, in a sense working commonly to be ready to move on beyond the terrace of wrath. Again, we go from confrontation to cooperation with both the avaricious and the prodigal.
Okay, so Statius continues his story, and it turns out that, you know, if what you got up until this point, you know, somebody going to nowadays, let's say, to the Oxford Classical Dictionary and looking up Statius, it would kind of correspond. But here Dante the poet takes this very, very radical step and presents us with a very different Statius than the one of recorded history. He tells a little bit about his career and about the poems that he wrote and that he was famous for. One of the things I think that would be particularly important in our discussion is that for people in the Middle Ages, he was the most important source for the story of Thebes and all of the things that happened to Thebes. So that we saw that, for example, in looking at Ugolino and Ruggieri, that sort of compared to stuff that happens at the siege of Thebes. And so for that, he was an important poet, and like Virgil, a very important political poet. So again, the Statius of history would have that in common with the figure that is presented here. But Dante has a really interesting question about all of this, because there's no evidence from any of this that Statius was a Christian, even though he lived after the coming of Christ. He really, according to what everybody thought, had no particular knowledge of or interest in that kind of stuff. So this is the way in which the question is posed to him. from what you wrote in Clio's Company, it does not seem that you were faithful then to that faith without which virtue is in vain. He's saying, how come you're here among the saved? This certainly seems to be against everything that we saw earlier. And of course, in particular, it's against everything that we've seen back there in Inferno 4, which is, of course, where Virgil himself has his permanent home. So, if it be so, tell me what heavenly sun or earthly beam lit up your course so that you could set sail behind the fishermen. And Statius has the most interesting answer you could possibly hope for as Dante presents this wonderful, wonderful story of conversion.
It was you directed me to drink Parnassus waters. No problem up to here. You inspired me as a poet. It was you, still speaking to Virgil, whose radiance revealed the way to God. My conversion to Christianity was started by you. And that you is Virgil, the pagan poet, who, of course, lived before the time of Christ and who has this permanent dwelling place in limbo. How can this be so? You were the lonely traveler in the dark who holds his lamp behind him, shedding light not for himself, but to make others wise. What Virgil knew was not enough to save him. But what Virgil did was, it's a wonderful image, sort of take his light and hold it behind him so that that light guides others who could go, therefore, farther than Virgil went himself. And the specific text that's pointed to is, in fact, not a text in the Aeneid, but rather a text in a poem called the Fourth Eclogue of Virgil. For you once wrote, quote, "The world is born again, justice returns, and the first age of man and a new progeny descends from heaven." A poem that historians today would say was probably written about the birth of an heir to the Emperor Augustus. But given the fact that Statius lived after the time of Christ, Statius could read that poem and find more in it than Virgil himself knew. And therefore, it was that that began Statius turning toward God, began his conversion.
So you have Virgil accomplishing more for Statius than Virgil was able to accomplish for himself. A very interesting and important paradox. Now, we've already had reason to mention that there's a kind of connection between Statius and Dante, because, of course, both of them draw something from Virgil. This is sort of a shock to Virgil, needless to say, but again, it's sort of something that Dante himself has got to learn from. In other words, what Dante the poet is learning how to do in this journey is what Statius has already done. Take things in Virgil that go beyond the use that Virgil himself was able to make of them. And so what we have is Dante implicitly making the same kind of claim for himself and his own poetry as something that takes Virgil and goes beyond it. Again, in the structure of the poem itself, Virgil is Dante's guide, but only his guide so far, only his guide up to a point. And so this particular interchange between Dante and Virgil and Statius becomes particularly important because it's coming pretty close to the time when Virgil himself is going to leave, when Virgil is going to give over his guidance of the pilgrim to Beatrice. And so what we see here, I think, in this notion of Statius's conversion to Christianity is a preparation for the obsolescence of Virgil in the poem.
In many ways, this passage makes us go all the way back to the beginning of the poem, and it helps to answer some questions that perhaps perplexed readers at the beginning. Why would Dante have a pagan guide through the Christian afterlife? Why would there be a lot of references to pagan ideas, pagan philosophers, pagan poets, and whatever? Why would even much of the structure of hell be based on Virgil's description of the afterlife in the Aeneid, Book 6? I think at first that sort of puts off a lot of readers who wonder, isn't Dante just sort of freely mixing stuff because he's just trying to borrow the best pieces possible? But I think we can see now that we need the classical world as guides. We need to be able to read it differently than people living in that world read. We now have the advantage of reading it through the lens of the incarnation, the crucifixion, and the resurrection. But that new lens allows us to find more in those poems than the poets or the historical figures or whatever knew or were conscious of knowing was part of their own writing, their own lives.
Now, the journey continues. Again, it's important to keep in mind that now the journey is the three of them walking up together. That is to say, Virgil and Statius, as well as Dante. And interestingly enough, in the next several cantos, as we're heading to the final two circles, final two terraces that need purging, Dante runs into one after another of his own more immediate poetic predecessors. Okay, one way to take a look at it, of course, is that Virgil writes in Latin, but Dante makes the very important decision that he's going to write in Italian. Statius, as another Latin poet, learns from Virgil. And now what we have is Dante meeting a bunch of poets who wrote in Dante's own language, who lived in the generations before him, and who were some of them alive in his own time. And he has an encounter with all of these poets. And I think what we're meant to do is to sort of look at this very carefully and say, well, okay, what he sees in these poets is something about his own poetic career. But also, he's going to have to look at these poets in much the same way that Statius has looked at Virgil, to take from them what is most valuable and to take from them what might even be beyond what they themselves realized they had. Okay? We have this remarkable series of encounters which sort of all add up to a kind of analogy between Dante and a group of vernacular poets and Statius and Virgil, going beyond, seeing more in them than they were aware, and seeing something in them also which needs to be Christianized.
Before we turn to the first one of those poets, I simply want to introduce him by pointing this out. It's a fellow named Ferrese Donati, and we meet him in Canto 23. What I want to suggest as a historian of this pair is that Ferrese, a member of the Donati family, first of all, the Donati family were the political enemies of Dante. They were the leaders of the Black Guelphs. Secondly, the Donati family is one of the very few families that has people in all three parts of Dante's afterlife. We met one in Inferno 25. We will meet another at the beginning of the Paradiso. So this is another one of those families, like the family of the Emperor Frederick II, that we want to sort of remember, because we can go back and sort of look at that family and learn things about family, as well as things about inheritance and so many other issues. So it's interesting, the first one that Dante chooses to have people this poetic heavy part of the purgatory is in fact a very careful choice, not just for poetic, but for other reasons as well.
Now, Frazi's no great poet, an analogy that might be a little bit far-fetched. I was talking the other day about the fact that my brother is a very, very good chess player, sort of ranked and all that kind of stuff. And somebody said, oh, you must have fun playing with him. I said, no, that's ridiculous. It would last him four moves and he would beat me. I taught him the moves of chess. He's younger than I am, but 8 years. But, you know, by the time that he had been playing the game for a couple of months, he could slaughter me, and I haven't played chess with him in 20 years. Essentially, Ferrese and Dante used to sort of exchange insult poems with each other. They were as sophisticated as sort of nice Italian rhymed versions of your mother wears combat boots sorts of things. And so it's kind of like this is how he got his start in the poetry biz, but don't expect to find a lot of Ferrese Donati poems in any anthology of Italian literature. But the interesting thing is that there they were talking to each other in this sort of shorthand code language. And at this point, all right, in purgatory. Forese says, you know, in fact, it was the love of a virtuous woman that enabled me to get as far as I am now in purgatory. Now, sort of good for my life, if not for my poetry. And they begin talking about the sort of degeneration of values and virtue in Florence, not surprisingly. But the way it continues, it seems pretty clear that this joking poetry that Dante and Forese exchanged when they were youths couldn't really deal with the seriousness of the issue that they bring up here in Purgatory. In other words, one of the limits of this early poetry is that it couldn't take into account any of the important societal or what we've been calling political issues of Florence or of Italy as a whole. And so what Dante is doing is going to these poets who start out very personally. That's what they want to talk about. But in the background is the model of the two great political poets, Virgil on the one hand and Statius, who has learned from him. And so while Dante is learning the kind of personal love part of his craft from the poets in the vernacular, he has to also learn the political part of his craft from Virgil and now from the combo of Virgil and Statius.
We have then in the next canto, in canto 24, a whole gathering, it seems, of poets. Again, folks who are very close in time to Dante. And this is a place where, among other things, we talk a great deal about style, because there was a great deal of stylistic development and innovation that ultimately began with the troubadour poets in southern France, sort of went in a particular form to Sicily, and then came to northern Italy. And therefore, there was not just discussion about the substance of poetry in Dante's time, but also the style, the best way of expressing what a poet wants to express. And it's here in Purgatory 24 that Dante meets a whole bunch of these fellows, and they talk, if you will, about both style and substance.
Yeah, and one of the ways it's done is that he meets this poet from Lucca, a guy named Buonaggiunta. And Buonaggiunta, by the way, we're still in the Terrace of the Gluttons. You go from the Gluttons a little bit later to the last of the terraces, that of Lust. Buonaggiunta is talking about various poetic things and recognizes Dante, and recognizes Dante as somebody who is a guy who got it better than he did. Notice, of course, that's been prepared for by what we said about artistic pride and humility back there on the Terrace of the Proud. But he looks at Dante and he says, tell me, do I not see standing here him who brought forth the new poems that begin, ladies who have intelligence of love? Okay, so essentially what happens is that Buonaggiunta is quoting one of the lines from one of Dante's greatest hits, that is to say, one of his earlier love poems. And Dante, sort of, you know, trying to be somewhat modest, but also take credit for that, says, I am the one who, when love inspires me, takes careful note and then gives form to what he dictates in my heart. Okay, in other words, what Dante is doing is defining the poetic process there. And essentially saying, you know, when Buonaggiunta says, you know, your thing is you knew the right way to talk about love, Dante says a little bit about this is how I do it. And so Buonaggiunta says, my brother, now I see the knot that held back Guittoni and the notary and me back from the sweet new style I hear. In other words, that explains why we weren't as good as you were, that we didn't, you know, we didn't get this love stuff right. But this is really tricky. I mean, remember, love of the sort that appears in this kind of poetry is the very thing that got somebody like, well, let's say, Francesca da Rimini in big trouble back in the Inferno. And so the question is this good or not? And the answer is, it really depends on the kind of love that you're talking about, the kind of love that Dante is following. And it seems to me that at this point, essentially, what we're finding out is that if you think about it in terms of Dante's earlier poetry, it's love that could have gone either way, right? And it seems like if you follow the example of Statius and Virgil, what Dante has to do is play Statius to his earlier predecessors and learn how to take that impulse for love poetry and somehow Christianize it in the same way that Statius Christianizes Virgil's political poetry.
It's also interesting, this fellow Guitone, whom Dante mentions here, is the guy who wrote a famous poem about Florence, a lament for Florence, after the Battle of Monteperti. And in fact, shortly after this discussion that we've just talked about, we go back to talking about politics, because it's so important for us to remember that politics and poetry are not two separate activities. That one of the things that Dante needs to do, it seems to me, is to understand the highest calling of the poet, which is not only to talk about the things of the individual and the things of the heart, but also the way people as society operate together. And so the fact that Forese flashes back into a discussion of Florence, and the fact that Guitone was in fact a poet who wrote this sort of funny poem, if you will, not funny in the sense of humorous, about Florence's demise at Monteperti, reminds us of another quality that Dante needs to infuse into his poetry.
And the discussion continues. When they get to the next terrace, the Terrace of Lust, Dante meets some more of his poetic predecessors. In fact, one of the people he meets is the first Guido that we saw in Purgatorio 11, a guy named Guido Guinicelli, who sort of gave way to the second Guido, Guido Cavalcante. And he's here now, okay, as kind of a little bit of an MC for Dante, talking about the other folks who were there. He says, I can fulfill your wish. I am Guido Guinicelli, here so soon, for I repented long before I died. Now, it's interesting that we don't find out a whole heck of a lot about what his individual sins are, but remember, he's in the Terrace of Lust here, which means that part of what's going on might well be repenting of the tendency toward lust that's in the poetry itself. And here, his job seems to be to point out to Dante earlier poetic masters in the vernacular, okay, in the Romance European languages, going all the way back to the 12th century, and they're all here together in need of that same kind of purgation from the sin of lust. So what we have here at the end of this canto, what we have is a sort of conclusion to a movement that really started with Francesca in Inferno 5 that implicates Dante in a relationship with all of his previous poetic predecessors, and they all stand together in need of this purgation of the sin of lust.
And now, after Dante leaves this terrace, all seven P's, standing for the seven sins, are erased from his brow, and he's ready to enter the earthly paradise, and pretty soon, finally, to meet Beatrice.
Lecture 17, Dante's New Guide.
As we saw in the last lecture, the last of the terraces up the seven-story mountain is the place for the purgation of the sin of lust. Dante and Virgil pass through a refiner's fire at the end of that terrace and find themselves in a new place altogether. We are going not so much back to the future as forward to the past, because once they pass through the last of these seven terraces up the mountain, they find themselves at the earthly paradise. That is to say, the Garden of Eden, as it existed, and as it would have, as it existed before the fall of Adam and Eve, and as it would have existed if the fall had not taken place. So the souls who come to this place are those who have regained their innocence and regain their integrity, and are now ready, if you will, to enjoy the vision of paradise. for Dante, what it means is that the earthly paradise becomes kind of the launching pad for his journey into paradise, which will, of course, be the third part of the poem. But it also means that an awful lot of things take place in these final cantos as Dante is there sort of getting ready for this journey. First of all, and perhaps most important, he loses the guide who has been with him all the way through two-thirds of the poem, which is to say he loses Virgil, but he gains Beatrice as the guide for most of paradise. And this transition is something that we're going to be spending a good deal of this particular lecture on. In addition, what Dante does there is sort of watch pageants that take place that really give him information, really provide a kind of preview of coming attractions for what's going to happen in paradise, and also recapitulate what has already happened on his journey, which is now, of course,